Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap with me, Andy, and Mike Donahue. Mike, how are you doing?
Doing great. Doing great, Andy. How are you?
Never better.
Good.
A little sleep deprived.
Me too. Yeah.
You actually 16. Worked.
Yeah.
You were an actual election judge. So since I have you on the podcast, can you tell me what you did to actively steal votes for Joe Biden?
I was worried I was going to run out of the Costco the garbage bags.
Yeah. Did you hand out Sharpies to the Trump voters so their votes wouldn't count?
Yeah. We saw that, and it would. And I had a mail-in ballot, and I got nervous that I used a Sharpie at home. And you know, this was a few weeks ago, so I switched over. But I did learn yesterday, and you could see it if you look at the ballot. Anyone that used a Sharpie is it. You know, you can put it on the other side, but it does not invalidate the ballot. They are there to read them to be in the proper hole, as long as you get them in the hole. And so they made sure that the holes were not lined up on opposite sides. But yeah, it was an interesting 16-hour day. It wasn't crazy where I was at. I was at a small precinct. It was actually in a clubhouse at a condominium. A lot of older people. So this particular precinct, definitely, you know, I could tell went to Donald, but it was not big. Nobody gave attitude. Everybody wore masks. Nobody electioneered. I was prepared for all that because of all the hubbub. So it was pretty straightforward. But yeah, long day, and you know, here we are.
Were you a little disappointed? You wanted to at least get to crack one head, and then nobody would act up.
I did have one incident, it wasn't along partisan lines. I think it was an older Polish gentleman with his wife, poor woman, we talked about this afterwards amongst the other judges. She probably absolutely dreads election day because kind of the old world, old fashioned husband basically wanted her vote, and he had a little bit better command. And we kind of noticed a little bit of, you know, untoward behavior. You're supposed to keep yourself in the polls. So I walked over there, and like the guy kind of caught my eye, and I could tell he was, you know, they were muttering to each other in Polish, and she was already done sitting in a chair next to him. And I saw them like hand the ballot. So obviously the guy is like trying to vote twice. I could have rung him up. But, you know, I'm not going to try to make a mountain out of a molehill. I stood there, and he got pissed, and it was pretty funny. I mean, nothing was going to happen. I'm not looking for a confrontation, but I think I know my presence there, at least in that situation, was probably good. I was the only male judge out of the five, and I think they were happy just to have me stand there. And, you know, yeah. I'm not going to engage the guy. And he looks over his shoulder at me, and he's frustrated because I knew that he was stymied. He's like, I've been coming here 20 years and whatever.
It's my I voted 40 times in 20 years. Wait a minute. Never mind what I said.
At one point, he took the ballot back and I didn't say anything. I'm right there, though. And then she must have made a mistake because he's like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, he's like, so the poor woman's embarrassed. She's humiliated. Like, she was trying to say, it's okay, it's okay. And, you know, I'm not looking to, you know, ignite the situation. I just want the guy to wrap up and get out. And he's muttering that, you know, I'm going to file a complaint, you know, and you got to let him vent because what we talked about afterwards. I mean, if I wanted to be a real hard ass about it, it was absolutely not what he was doing. I could have reported him and made a deal out of it, invalidated. I let him finish, but that was the only drama that I had. It was just sort of standing between an old world Polish husband and his wife as he basically tried to bully her vote out of her.
So I'm waiting to get a phone call from the Justice Department requesting me to testify against the postmaster, Louis DeJoy.
Oh, is that right?
Both me and my wife and myself requested mail-in ballots from the state of Illinois, and we did not get them.
Ah, okay. So
we could track. We could track it, and they were sent on the first day, September 24th, that they were allowed to mail them out, and it never came.
Okay.
So a week ago, I went to the election office and went up and said, I didn't get it. Can I just vote in person? And they said, yes. Mm-hmm. And so they went into the little thing and basically canceled out my mail-in ballot.
That was smart that you did that, because as I learned yesterday in being a judge, that happened a lot. Sometimes they would bring in a spoiled ballot. Yep. They wanted, so there's a whole process, which also the experience showed me how absolutely, utterly absurd simpletons out there when they talk about stealing elections, and how it's like, I've seen it now, and I knew it anyway. I knew it as a voter. I knew that you would have to go so far out of your way, and the reward is not even worth it compared to the risk, and nobody really does it. And with those mail-ins, so if you didn't do that, if you just showed up at the polls, it was a little bit of a pain in the ass for you. If you didn't get it, you had to sign an affidavit, and then you would get – we would still give you a non-provisional ballot, but if we had evidence that they received it, they had to get a provisional. It's a whole type of thing. I learned all kinds of stuff yesterday, so I didn't mean to interrupt the conclusion of that story.
No, that was pretty much it.
It was smart that you went a week ahead, so they could. So when you went to the poll,
I didn't want to have to do that. I didn't want to have to go on election day.
So you just voted early then.
When there's a line and be like, I never got mine. There was a line anyway. I had to stand outside for like 15 minutes.
Oh man, you poor thing.
I survived.
Good for you.
Election fraud is a fantasy cooked up by people who've lost elections. Or who don't like the results of the election, and then they like to cook up these grand conspiracies as to why their favorite candidate really won, except it was stolen from them.
Right. Also, extremely dumb and gullible, I think is all. At least it's not the candidates, but
And all over Twitter today, they're doing these things where they're listing registered voters in a certain state, and then the total of who voted yesterday, and that number's higher. And then every time somebody's like, okay, well, your registered voter total is either from 2012 or 2016. So shut up.
Right. Right. Right.
Gone are the days. I mean, the whole myth around more people voted in the 1960 presidential election in Chicago than there were people in Chicago. There's that whole thing about how Frank Sinatra and the mob stole the election for John F. Kennedy. And they've always decided that's gone on forever.
Yep. No, it's lunacy. One of my wife's friends in Michigan, and she has a political agenda, and I'll leave it at that. just carelessly posted a thing. Oh, people stepping over this bag of so and so, right? Of ballots or something like that, suggesting. Okay, I just jump right in. I'm like, so you reported them, right? Like, if that actually happened, which it didn't. She's full of shit. Yeah. She's trying to engender. I know it's impossible that to happen. And we're just having been around it. My mom was a judge when I was a kid. I know that, and I did it. Yesterday, and of course, she didn't really have a sensible reply. But yeah, if you see that, fucking report it, because people that work those things take it seriously. So, yeah.
Do we know if Todd Ricketts tried to vote with a picture of a ballot from 8 years ago? Or anything? I don't know.
He showed his tax bill as proof of ID.
I'm sure people haven't tuned in to hear election chat with Mike. Yeah. Hayden, but they got a little of it anyway.
Thus concludes our civics talk.
So this week, our beloved Bears, whose season feels like it's hanging in the balance, despite the fact that they're 5-3, which I don't think any of us expected, but it's not what your record. Well, it is what your record is, Bill Parcells, but it's also how you get there, and that's a little concerning. But that's not what this podcast is about either. We remember crap, and so we're going to remember the Houston Oilers / Tennessee Oilers / Tennessee Titans.
Mm-hmm.
And for those youngins among our listeners, and there are some among and some Swedes who might not know what we're talking about. The Oilers, the good old Houston Oilers, were born in 1960. And do you know when they won their first AFL championship?
So that presumes that they did win an AL championship, championship, which would be between 1960 and 1969, which was the last season of the AFL. I couldn't even fathom against it. Did they win the first one?
Yes.
With George Landa, though?
They won the first. I don't know. Did the AFL begin in 1960?
I thought it did.
They won the first two. 1960 and 1961, with different coaches.
Wow.
The great Lou Rimkus. Of course, you remember Lou. He won the first one. And then Wally Lem, of course. Everybody remembers Wally Lem. Wally won the second one. And it looks like Lou coached 19 games. It's weird, and I probably should have figured this out before. So Lou coached 19 games. Wally only coached 9. So
did Lou have a heart attack in the second season?
He may have. Lou may have died, and then Wally took over. And Wally went 9-0, and then won the title game. So he only coached 10 games ever for the Oilers. Won them all.
And a championship?
Won the big one, and was named the AFL Coach of the Year. He's the anti-Rick Venturi. And I meant to bring this up. The Athletic, I guarantee you it's because they listen to the podcast, they have a feature story on Rick Venturi.
Who was the center of about a 10-minute conversation that we had last week.
Yes.
Whose career coaching Division I college and pro was, I believe, 346-1?
It was
something like that.
Yeah, it was amazingly terrible.
Uh-huh. I mean, really, must be the worst of all time.
You can say that and people laugh, but no. I mean, you'll never... Hired to be Fired, The Life and Times of Rick Venturi by the great Bob Kravitz.
What a legacy. What a legacy.
Appeared today.
So our guy, what was it, Wally, was Lamb the,
Wally Lem,
the replacement?
Yep, the Lamb, anti-Rick, never lost.
Okay, yeah, I'm looking at
it.
Yeah, he did come back, though, to sully his career. But he did leave Houston after 9-0 and winning the championship. Yeah. You know what it was? He won the championship in the AFL, and then the very next year, the Cardinals hired them.
He wanted to go to the real league. He went to the...
Exactly. That's exactly what that must have been. And the Cardinals were new. They left. I believe it would not have been their first season after having moved out of Chicago's South Side. But it's 60, I want to say that their first season was 60. But early on, the Cardinals must have come a-calling, and that was enough to get... Wally Lemon has 1,000 winning percentage and AFL championship to jump ship. So
now you of all people, this is completely off the, but you of all people, I'm sure knows why the Chicago, they probably got the jerseys first and then picked a name, but you know why they were red and white.
Right. Not just red, but maroon.
Maroon. Yes. I didn't want to lead the,
right.
I want to lead the
There's
witness.
A certain type of red. Yeah, you know, yeah, so they were actually probably more of a literal descendant of the famous Amos Alonzo Stagg University of Chicago Maroons, who are definitely named for their jerseys. I think we kind of associate the Bears with them because of the nickname that the media gave the Bears, the Monsters of the Midway, but the Bears are actually borrowed more as far as like font or color from University of Illinois, right. At least the colors.
Yeah, to show you how cheap. What a low-rent thing the NFL was when it started. The Bears wear navy blue and orange because Halas bought a bunch of old jerseys from Illinois.
His alma mater.
The Cardinals are red and white, or they became, and they picked their nickname to go with it because they bought a bunch of used crap from the University of Chicago.
Right, just a few miles away in Hyde Park.
Yeah, because for a long time, college football was, that was football. And the NFL was like this barnstorming sideshow.
Yep.
You know, people nowadays wouldn't conceive of it. You know, a college game on a Saturday would get... You know, good old Soldier's Field under the old thing. They get 130,000 people in there. And just like the Soldier Field that you and I went to as kids, about 12 of them could actually see what was going on the field.
Right.
And then the Bears would play, although there was a reason the Bears went and played at Wrigley Field for a long time, because they didn't need a stadium the size of Soldier's Field.
Right. And pre-Red Grange, this was absolutely the truth. And even post-Grange for another, while. But until Grange... College football was played by upstanding, college people, right? It was a more noble sport. Professional football was a little bit more roguish, and it did not have anywhere near the cachet that it does today, especially compared to college. College was the regal, the immaculate competition.
Yep. And now you scoff at that, Now it's which league can exploit athletes more? And the NCAA wins that.
Right, because they're not even pretending to pay him. So.
Oh, I should have read ahead. Wally didn't just sully his record with the Cardinals. He came back to coach the Oilers.
I just saw that.
28-38-4. So, so he was not. He should have stuck at the 10-0.
You know, that reminds me of Adam Greenberg, who, you know, who had an immaculate 1,000 on base percentage after seeing one major league pitch, and somehow decided to let the Mets pander to him about 6 years later by coming back, even though it was completely unmerited, and thus became one of thousands of ball players otherwise that did not have any sort of a distinction. That would have been Wally. He was 9. So yeah, he flames out in the NFL, comes back to Houston in 66. To reclaim the glory, and and now we had to look him up on Pro Football Reference to even know who he was.
So Greenberg, it was the Marlins, maybe against the Mets, because I think Ozzie, was that the year Ozzie managed the Marlins? I'm pretty sure Ozzie Guillen was his manager.
Ozzie only there 1 year, or am I thinking of Joe Girardi?
Joe was only there 1 year, right? One manager of the year and got fired. Ozzie was there. Let's see. Come on, internet. He was there in 2012. Was he there? I don't think he was there in 2011. So he was also
a 1 year wonder.
A 1 year wonder. Yep. Got himself a nice fat contract and then got canned after 1 year. Nice work if you can get it and lose it. So good job.
Incidentally, because I was curious why this first coach of the Houston Oilers in the first year of their existence, you know, disappeared halfway through the second season. I thought maybe he died of a heart attack.
Oh, you know what would be great, though? It would be if he was drilling for oil in his backyard and it hit. And he just quit. He's like, hey, fuck you guys. I got real money. Boots, you know, popping up in my backyard.
And here's something that I've learned tonight. This coach, Lou Ripkus, did not die halfway through the 1960s. In fact, he lived all the way till 1998. Hmm. Shortly after a Bears-Titans game, October 3, died on Halloween 1998. So he lived a long life. But interestingly, he was a Notre Dame grad, and he played high school at Tilden, Illinois.
Oh, there you go.
Which, if I'm not mistaken, I want to say Johnny Kerr went to, but I could be wrong. So don't quote me on that. So, Lou Rimkus, well, I salute you.
Among great Oilers coaches, of former Bear offensive coordinator Ed Hughes.
Coach Ed Hughes was a Oilers head coach?
1971, 4-9-1.
Wow. He was the Bears offensive coordinator, right?
Yes. He was the one Ditka would go rip the play sheet out of his hand and then just take over when things were going bad.
Okay.
Among others. I'm sure Ed wasn't the only one.
Yeah, I always had a hard time remembering exactly who the Bears OC. I think they had maybe a couple back then.
I think Ed was named Plum. I think he won a Super Bowl ring as offensive coordinator.
Okay, so it was the 85. Because, it's not hard to remember a lot of the Bears' defensive coordinators.
Yep, offensive coordinator Ed Hughes.
Ed Hughes, all right. I must be thinking of maybe some of the more position coach. Ted Plum was the name I was thinking, but he might have been like a tight end.
He was the receivers coach. Dick Stanfell was the offensive.
Dick Stanfell.
Jim Dooley. Okay. Was the offensive consultant.
And the former head coach too. He came back. He was a head coach.
It's funny they list all those offensive guys, and then they list Buddy Ryan, and then nothing. There's no defensive coaches listed.
No defensive. But like, no defensive myself, line guys. Coach.
I did it all. Didn't need
that's
angry.
Great.
Of course,
Buddy was
Buddy's there's a tie-in obviously there with
Buddy
the,
was
with
a coach
Oilers.
In Houston as defensive coordinator. I didn't even think of bringing that up at all today, but it popped into my head because it was a pretty hilarious one season. Do you remember any of the details about Buddy Ryan? I have a pretty vivid recollection.
I remember because you. I remember Buddy punching Kevin Gilbride on the sideline.
Okay, that will fit into the story. If you back up a little bit, the Houston Oilers, you know, we are playing the Tennessee Titans, but again, we'll recall this is the same franchise, so this is relevant. Houston Oilers in 1992 suffered, I think it's statistically the worst blown lead in NFL playoff history. to the Buffalo Bills in 1992. And it did not cost Jack Pardee the job as head coach, but it did cost Houston their job, or Houston's defensive coordinator, his job. And Buddy had been fired from as head coach of the Eagles about a year earlier. He'd been out of football, I think, maybe a year. And they brought him back because that defense blew a 32-point lead in the second half. Now, when Buddy came into training camp, his whole thing was, this defense isn't really that bad. My issue, and this was making news in training, that offense has a 32-point lead, and they're freaking throwing the ball, and they don't know how to, like, run out of clock. And, you know, he wasn't denying that he could improve the defense, but he really brought a lot of attention to the fact that this run-and-shoot offense and he was taking shots across the bow in the media before the season started at offensive coordinator Kevin Gilbride. And so that was already – that was in training camp. You know, Buddy makes it clear, you know, that they, you know, both sides of the ball have to improve. And so Houston has a phenomenal season. I want to say they go 13-3. They made it to the title game, but of course Joe Montana with the Chiefs stuck it to Buddy again, and stuck it to Buddy at least for the second time. But before that, towards the end of the season, as Houston was rallying towards the playoffs, I can let you finish because I think you probably have more of those details in mind, and on a Sunday night game perhaps too.
Yeah, the punch was in a regular season game, right? And then in the playoffs, they played the Joe Montana Chiefs.
Right.
And blew a lead. And the most famous image was a tight end for the Chiefs. I can't think of what it was. Catches a touchdown pass, runs into the end zone, and one of the fans in the Astrodome had hung this huge banner that had a spray-painted caricature of Buddy. And the Chiefs player took the ball and threw it right and hit him right in the face with the ball in the end zone.
But a couple weeks prior to that, Buddy kind of creates a little bit of a toxic environment in the beginning of the season. But they play well, but then tensions boil over in a game late in the season, and there's like at that point, 68-year-old Buddy Ryan. Yeah. Lunging on the sidelines to cold cock his offensive counterpart. So, good old Buddy.
Yeah, it's not surprisingly, if you Google Buddy Ryan, Kevin Gilbride, it's what comes up.
Yeah, not surprisingly.
It seems like it was a Sunday night game, but I seem to remember like Paul McGuire and Mike Patrick losing their shit. Yeah, it was 1993. The Oilers that year were 12-4.
12-4. I was off by a game. Okay. Yeah, I mean they when they lost to Montana and the Chiefs, they were at home. I mean they were a 1 or 2 seed that season. So they did improve after blowing that playoff game the year before. They ran into Montana who had one last bullet, I guess. And
So it was a game against the Jets. It says a nationally televised contest. So back then that's either Sunday or Monday night. The Oilers were up 14-0 with the half coming up, and Kevin Gilbride decided deep in their own end that they were going to chuck it around and gain some pick up some more yards. Warren Moon must have been hurt or just took a week off. Cody Carlson fumbled at his own 18-yard line with 24 seconds left in the half.
I can picture the rage bubbling up right now as you describe this.
And that's
play
what
play.
Buddy went over and took a swing at Kevin Gilbride.
Well, you know, he was consistent. That was his point in training camp. That if you the defense, you can have a great offense, but there are times when you have to manage the clock. You can't just be thinking of scoring all the time or pushing the football all the time. Through the air, especially. Oh, man. Kevin Gilbride. Was he ever head coach? He ever get his own gig? He worked for a while.
Everywhere.
Yeah, I don't know if he ever did.
So the Oilers, a well-established, successful franchise in football-crazed Houston, decided that they wanted their own. They didn't want to be in the Astrodome anymore. They wanted a new fangled stadium with, luxury boxes and all that stuff. And the city of Houston was not playing along. So they went off and started talking to to Nashville, Tennessee, about moving there.
And yeah, I don't because think, when you're in the fifth largest city in the country already, why not go to like the 18th, right?
Yeah, right. So it's a very savvy move.
18th might be high.
They convinced the city of Nashville to build them a stadium, and said, "Screw it, we're going." And the problem was, you can't just set up a stadium overnight. So Nashville said, "We're going to need 2 years." So the Oilers were going to stay in Houston, and that lasted about 10 minutes. And they realized that their fans now hated them, and they better get out of town. So they had to come up with an interim home. And the Nashville offered up, "Hey, come play at Vanderbilt." And they didn't like that idea because the stadium at Vanderbilt only seats 40,000 people, and that wasn't going to be enough. So they decided, we'll inch our way across the state. We'll just stop in Memphis for a couple of years, build up our rabid fan base out there in West Tennessee, and then we'll take them towards the middle of the state with us. And just think how
it's like it's like a pilgrimage.
It is, really. And Jeff Fisher was the coach, so you know you could see him, you know, playing the flute and with all the rednecks jogging along behind him. So the Liberty Bowl in Memphis seats 60,000 people. That's more like it. That's what we want. So they moved there. So 1997, they are the Tennessee Oilers. They haven't decided what they're going to call themselves. And people in Memphis just couldn't get enough of the Tennessee Oilers. They loved them. First game, I think it was against the Raiders. They filled half of the Liberty Bowl, 30,171. Subsequent weeks, they would have liked to have gotten filled half. 17,737, 17,071, 27,208, 26,744. They,
for NFL football,
they had a total home attendance. So eight home games, 224,000 people.
So here, all right, I know they weren't planning on being in Memphis permanently, but here's a question that popped into my head. And I don't know how it works nowadays. I've kind of assumed it to be the same. But if you don't sell out your games, at least sell out all your tickets, then you're blacked out in the market. I know it hasn't happened for the Bears since 1984, believe it or not, because normally corporations would never swoop in. It hasn't been an issue. Maybe that's not anymore. But I'm thinking, well, it's kind of hard to build your brand if none of the games are on local television, which I don't think they would have been if they're not selling that place out. That's just a side note.
Yeah, because that was, you know, are blackouts even a thing anymore?
I don't know. See, I was thinking about that. I don't know what they are because how the hell.
You never hear about it, ever.
Right.
And it used to be like wouldn't it be great if they were enforcing it this year?
Well, I mean.
right. We're not allowed to have anybody. Well, I'm sorry. Your game can't be on TV. It says right here in the rule book.
So you remember,
we can't sell tickets.
Living out by Rockford, would you have been affected then? Were you far enough where it didn't matter? You were maybe more at the mercy of whether the game would be on in your region.
Boy,
all I know
question.
Is that because the Bears were not always that good, shocker, because you spent a lot of time picking it over. But in the early 80s, the Bears were usually not very good. So I remember oftentimes there would be this concern, like on Wednesday before the home game. And you know, we had some tickets, but of course not everyone's able to go. Ooh, the 3-6 Bears might not be on television if there's not a, if they're not sold out. And then usually is how my dad would explain it. Well, like some local businesses, whatever, would end up like buying the glut of the tickets that end up being saved. But there were times that I remember, I have a living memory of not being able to watch the Bears on TV. One of them was actually the opening the first game of the season in 1984, right when the Bears were starting to get good. They played the Buccaneers, and this is 1984. And I remember like half of the family piling into my dad's car. You know, we'd done a little bit of research in the Yellow Pages. Basically, we're like driving through various Northwest suburban towns looking for that dish. All right. That was like on top of the, and then investigate. All right, kids, stay in the car. I'm going to go in and see if they're going to have the Bears game. And I remember we like stopped at three play. We went with like Arlington Heights, Mount Prospect. We ended up in Schaumburg. And then the game had already started. We heard Dennis McKinnon level a block on Tampa Bay's Mike Washington that ended his career, which, you know, proved McKinnon was more than just a receiver. But yeah, the first game of the year, like we basically had to travel around till we could find a satellite dish to watch the Bears in a bar. And that was the thing. So that's a good question. I'd like to know, because it would, you would think that during like the late Wannstedt years, right? Like how the hell were those games always selling out? Cause they were all on TV. Cause of course I was committed to watching them. So, but yeah, sorry for the regression on blackouts. But if that was applying in 1996, 1997, when the Oilers had moved to Memphis, then, you know, they weren't going to stay there anyway. But they certainly wouldn't have been on television with attendance that low if they still had that policy.
Yeah, I can't answer the question about whether we would have been affected watching the Rockford stations. Probably not. You know, it's...
So you're 70 lucky.
Miles from Soldier Field, probably.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're okay. You had a different area code and everything. Yeah.
If not, you just head up to, you know, Beloit, sit right. Bar, scare off the Packer fans. Actually, there would have been not then, but there would be times in more recent years where the local affiliate would be like, "Oh, you mean we'll have to show the Packer game instead? Oh, that's too bad." Because there are Packer fans who get pissed off all the time. Like, we're in first place, the Bears are in last place in the station, and you'll know it because the little sports guys in town will be like, "Yeah, come on, don't forget on Sunday we've got, you know, Bears Jets. We have to show it. It's how it works."
Sorry, folks.
So don't call.
Chicago's still closer than Green Bay.
So the Oilers. So they decided after 97. You know what? Vandy sounds pretty good. So they went, they played that next season at Vanderbilt, and they upped their attendance by a total that year of 50,000 people. So pretty much the same. They had to be a little concerned about just how excited people in Tennessee were for them. But once they built the new stadium, they have not had problems drawing fans.
It didn't help that they were pretty bad around. It was after that whole Buddy Ryan, Jack Pardee, Warren Moon era. They were not very good either. You know, and I'm sorry, the stadium in Memphis they played, was that the Memphis Chicks? Like, where, I didn't catch
the Liberty Bowl. Stadium.
Oh, the Liberty Bowl. I'm sorry, you did say that. Okay, yeah. Okay.
Which is like a big, hideous cement thing with...
Who plays there, usually?
The University State of Memphis. Memphis State. Then they, I know, they became, right? University of Memphis. And then, of course, they actually have the Liberty Bowl every year. That's, you know, the mid-major bowl game that nobody wants to go to. Because Memphis in December, it might not snow, but it's still not going to be
there. It's long. Not that nice, yeah. So that was their play. That was their home in – so that would have been 96, right? And then – or 97.
That was 97. 98, they went to Vandy. In 99, they opened up whatever and, they called it, the Adelphia Coliseum or whatever they called it.
Yeah, and went to the Super Bowl in their only Super Bowl appearance, right? Their first year in that new stadium?
99.
Yeah.
Where they fell 1 yard short against Dick Vermeil and Mike Martz and the flying, the greatest show on turf.
I kind of like that team, actually, with McNair. Not as much as I like the Earl Campbell teams in the late 70s, but...
But it was great that the people, before they moved into the new stadium, the fans of Tennessee got the perfect Jeff Fisher experience, because you combine the year in Memphis and the year at Vanderbilt, and they went 16-16.
Wow! So
the guy who his whole career, except for, what, like two seasons, maybe, when they were... was either 7-9 or 8-8. Every year.
Yeah.
You could rely on Jeff for that. And maybe he got to St. Louis with the Rams, then that's all he was ever going to do was 8 or 7.
Yeah, he, you know, I mean, the early returns, we obviously in retrospect, it was obvious that he was not that good of a coach, but, you know, he was with them in Houston and Memphis, and then Tennessee's first stadium, and then Tennessee's second stadium. He took him to the Super Bowl. They're usually pretty competitive in the aughts, but I know that probably obscured a lot of the flaws that became more obvious as Fisher's coaching career went on. But he seemed like a pretty good coach in the early going. So
he's the I mean, he's the father of Tennessee pro football, I would think.
Sure.
I mean, they had their greatest success to this point under the great Jeff Fisher, who, I don't know if you know this, was an 85 Bear, although he was.
Yeah.
Did he play at all that year? Was he hurt the whole season?
Nope, he did not play. Asterisk.
He's very prominent, though, in the Super Bowl highlights on the sidelines. You see a lot of Jeff Fisher. Well, I think he knew where the camera was. And
he went to Southern Cal. He was always pretty glib, but I think also the narrative is that that was the year that he sort of started, like, you know, Buddy took him on his arm as a.
Well, that's probably why they didn't list any defensive coaches, because it was just Buddy and Jeff coaching everybody. Jeff
Fisher, right? Yeah. And in fact, it's probably in Jeff Fisher's best interest to play that up more now. Now that you look at his career and realize how ordinary it was.
Yeah, he's got a good mustache, though.
Sure.
He does. So he's got that going for him, which is
nice.
Nice.
Something.
So one of the things they didn't bring with them, when they moved into the new stadium, they decided to rebrand, which, I mean, there's got to be oil in Tennessee somewhere, right?
Wait, well, didn't Jed Clampett, was he from Tennessee or was he from Texas? I can't recall.
Is well, that he was in the Appalachians, right? I always assumed he was like West Virginia. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, I don't think there's oil there. Wait, so when they, just to finish up on this whole Memphis-Nashville shuttle, they remained the Oilers the year in Vanderbilt Stadium. So they're the Tennessee Oilers.
The first two seasons in Tennessee, they were officially the Tennessee Oilers.
Okay, so when they moved into the new stadium, that's when they rebranded.
Yes, that became the Tennessee Titans. And And gave up one of the iconic helmet and logos, the Oil Derrick. I mean, it's a nice, simple, cool helmet. They gave that up for the weird,
Is their logo
one of those
now?
Guys okay. calls it the flaming thumbtack or whatever the hell it is that's on the side of there.
Well, just the fact that I have to Google image what even their logo is, like, it doesn't even readily come to mind.
No, it's,
I know their colors.
Yeah, it's somehow they tried to tie in the city of Nashville flag in there somewhere, and then there's flames and all kinds of shit.
It's a flaming tee. You're right about that, Derek. That was an iconic.
Yeah, they were cool. You know, the baby blue and red.
Yeah.
Which they still, I mean, they kept now they have like four shades of blue and they have red. Mm-hmm. And they have some gray or silver or some shit. I mean, their uniforms are not terrible. I mean, it's not like they completely screwed them up. But the old ones were really good. And I always hate when a team screws up.
Well, it's mostly the logo itself and the uniforms and the other design, I think, right? Because the Derrick is what would constitute a logo, right?
Yeah. And then just they messed with the color scheme a little and
thought
they made it better. They didn't. So another thing that they didn't bring with them was an iconic NFL fight song. Right up there with Bear Down Chicago Bears and the whatever that thing is they sing in Washington. Like,
all right, so just
hail,
for all you
hail
youngsters
to the Redskins.
Right. Which honestly compels me to admit that was the first NFL fight song, Hail to the Redskins. And that got Hallis working on, I don't know, finding some musicians in a basement in some dungeon somewhere
How come he just didn't hire Ed to do it? Wasn't Ed a lounge singer?
Right. I thought he was his
driver.
Of course,
he was shiftless, and he didn't like. He didn't want him marry in Virginia, and he was not a fan for a long time.
It is George Hallis's driver, and then or chauffeur or whatever, and then ends up providing him like what 46 grandchildren or, Ed McCaskey. Did he? He didn't write. He had nothing to do with it.
No,
that's a
he had
complete out of the air joke. Yeah,
but Ed was a singer.
The Bears rope. But I did know that. But the Bears came out with Bear Down Chicago Bears in response to the Redskins fight song. They were big rivals. Those two are probably the premier teams in the early 40s. They met in the title game 3 out of 4 years, 40, 42, and 43. And George Preston Marshall, the Redskins owner, and they were the Redskins back there, so I can say that. They'd moved from Boston, which is funny when you think about it. Might still be the Redskins if they were in Boston, but they came out with that fight song, and then the Bears did, and then but the history of fight songs in the NFL is not necessarily uniform. So
no, another famous one, which now is sadly is lost because of relocation, is the disco version, San Diego Superchargers, which is if you Google that, it's an earworm. You will sing San Diego Superchargers all
day. Do you remember it? Would I remember it?
I only remember the chorus. But I still, when I see them, I think it. I immediately start to sing San Diego Superchargers to myself.
Is it from their inception in the NFL?
I don't know.
It's from the Fouts era.
I wasn't kidding. It's a disco song.
Okay, so,
It's not terrible. I mean,
would have been disco. Don Coryell, the Air Coryell.
Steve McGarry may have blown it up. It may be from that area. From that
sure.
Area.
Okay, I gotcha.
But another one that's iconic is the Oilers. Is the Houston Oilers fight song, which
I didn't know
it even has this. It has this very long first verse, which has a story. But all anybody ever remembers is the chorus, because they used to play it. You could hear it during games because they would play it. They scored a touchdown or whatever. And that was, people are going to love them singing on the podcast, but that was Houston Oilers, number one. We're the Houston Oilers, Houston Oilers, number one.
I remember that song.
The guy who wrote it is a guy named Lee Offman, O-F-M-A-N. So I'm going to guess probably George's uncle.
Right.
So some people listening at home, if they're old enough, are like, no, that's the Dolphins fight song.
What?
Miami Dolphins.
Are you shitting me?
Well, there's a reason. Lee Offman wrote both of them. He wrote the Dolphin one first.
Okay.
He had 10,000 copies made, and he went around trying to find an agent to help him sell it, and then going around trying to get it played on the radio, and then to just sell it out of his car, and he couldn't get anybody to buy it. So he wrote a slightly different version for the Oilers, and that one took off, and he actually got money for it. But it is the Dolphins actually still use his original, which they must have paid him something for.
So it was their official song.
Both teams, playing at the same time, had the same song. Okay.
But my question is, if they had already agreed to use it as their fight song, why the hell was this guy driving around trying to get radio stations to play? Like, why was he promoting it? He made it. The team
wasn't
adopted
catching on, and it's really weird because it was 1972. So
the year that Miami went undefeated.
So it's not like it's a bad year for the Dolphins and the fans aren't into it. It's like, no, this is the year they're going to be into it more than any.
And he actually he picked the perfect time to do this. Wow.
Actually, it says here that he got no traction until they won the Super Bowl.
Okay.
And then fans started to get played. But he
But what's funny is I never knew the Dolphins A had a fight song, and then B it was the Oilers.
I knew that somebody else had the Oilers had a fight song just like the Oilers. So I Googled it to find out.
I learned something new today. But I remember the Oilers song. That's what kind of causing me to reel.
Well, that's because you couldn't get enough Dan Pastorini, so you were tuning in every week.
Here's the thing. I don't know that I hated Pittsburgh, but I think, I don't know, I was only 7 years old when they won their fourth and final Super Bowl in the Bradshaw era. I think and that was the same year the Pirates won, and I respected the Pirates. I think I respected both of those teams, but I was terrified of them, and I just wanted them to lose, probably because I was so terrified of them. Definitely the Pirates, right? But, because the Pirates are badass, Parker and Stargell and Mike Easler. Right, in the black and gold. The Steelers, very similar. I know the Pirates World Series in 79 was a one-off, but the Steelers were perennially good from, the mid-70s on. But for whatever reason, what I'm saying is I don't know that I hated either team, but for some reason, maybe it was like rooting for the underdog, which came to me naturally as a kid. I remember rooting hard for the Oilers against Pittsburgh in the 19, I want to say it was the 79 AFC Championship game. Oilers are likable, man. Like Earl Campbell, even though we had Peyton, and I said in previous podcasts that I generally kind of got defensive and sneered towards like the likes of Tony Dorsett and Billy Sims because I was a little defensive about Peyton. I didn't really feel that way about Campbell, man. Campbell was just awesome. And Bump Phillips was awesome. So that must have been it. And I remember just watching that championship game, rooting hard, and they got hosed on a on an official's call. Pastorini to it was forget the receiver for Houston, but his feet were in bounds. If it happened today, Houston goes to the Super Bowl probably, or at least that game turns out differently. But they were, man, they were a really good team, but they were basically, they became really good for a short window when Pittsburgh was still dominant, and eventually it turned to dust. Bump Phillips left, and nothing really happened there until Buddy Ryan came in the late 80s. But yeah, that's what I got.
So another thing I remembered about them was during, I guess Dennis Miller was on Monday Night Football two seasons.
2000, 2001?
So his first season, one of the first games, I remember his, I don't know if this is exactly his first joke or not, but a player had had minor groin surgery. And Dennis said, it's only minor groin surgery if it's not your groin. Which I thought was funny.
It's good.
But he had so he's doing a Titans game, and they show Bud Adams in the owner's box, and they go back to maybe it might have even been the first game there. I don't know, but they go back to Dennis, and he says the field is real grass. Do you think that was artificial turf we saw there? Referring to Bud's obviously terrible toupee.
Wow.
I remember hearing it at the time thinking that was pretty funny because I always like a good toupee joke. Dennis had to, not only did they make him apologize, he had to insist that that was Bud's real hair.
Oh, Jesus Christ. You know what? People must have photos of Dennis Miller because I'm just going to say I don't care for him now. Sometimes I've even thought like he's been compromised. Like, why would he be relevant these days? Why would he be such a toady though? Like for the establishment, because I did like him back in the day, and I actually thought I didn't see what the problem with him was. I liked the idea, and I didn't think that it was a bad deal when he was in the booth those 2 years. And again, I'm not standing for Dennis Miller because I don't care for him now. But I didn't see that was really an issue, and he was otherwise universally mocked for that job, which I never quite got.
I'm looking at, but it might actually be Bud's hair. That might have been why he had to apologize. Now, there are certain pictures where he's let it grow out a lot, and he has it swooped over, and you're like, oh yeah, that's obviously a toupee. But then there's others where he's got it cut a little shorter. Actually, in later years, when he let it go gray, because he was also dyeing it, which wasn't helping.
Yeah,
that might be his hair. There's a picture here of him flipping off the camera. So I'm going to put that on the post, and people can judge for themselves. Maybe Dennis had to apologize or had to insist it was hair because it may have actually been hair.
I don't take back what I said about Miller being compromised, but maybe in that situation, yeah, he was forced to deal with the fact that
ESPN ombudsman
was truly at risk of slandering.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, that's hair, man.
That's hair. You gotta apologize.
Right. That is not a Paul Finnemore creation.
So I will admit I do not have a lot of memories of actual Bear Oilers or Titan matchups. The one game that immediately comes to mind, though, is I thought it was the first ever NFL game to end in overtime on a safety, but it was not. It was the second. But the Bears won 19-17 in Tennessee. Do you remember who got? It's kind of a trick question. I'll just tell you. Two players got credit for the sack.
It's 2004 was the season, right? Was one of them Agunlier?
Yes. He on the Bears one was out of Wally Agunlier. And the other was a guy who was around for quite a while.
Really?
Yes.
Was he a lineman like Agunlier?
It was two linemen meeting at the quarterback.
Was it Alex Brown?
It was Alex Brown. Alex Brown, out of Wally Agunlier. And do you know... Who Do you know who they sacked?
Oh, was it Billy Volek?
It was. It was Billy Volek. And the best part of this was Wally, the guy he beat for the sack, future Bear, Fred Miller.
Oh.
And Olin Cruz probably wanted to go over and punch him in the face.
That's right.
So on the, was it last week? On the postgame? Yeah, I think it was last week on the postgame show. Because it's Olin Cruz, Lance Briggs, Alex Brown, and
Cap. Okay.
And they have the postgame show on whatever Comcast Sportsnet is now, NBC Sports Chicago. It was either that week or the week before. No, they were talking about the Javon Wims play and what a knucklehead and should they get rid of him. And Olin is sitting there and everybody kind of looks at him and he's like, I don't think I should probably comment on this. Because I had a rather public or a kind of a famous incident where I did something and I'm glad I didn't get unconditionally released.
I give Olin credit for being self-aware.
Yep. And the other two laughed, you know, kind of annoying, like, eh.
Well, because they were all teammates.
Olin's really good on that show.
Yeah, Olin's actually, I hear him on the score. He's actually pretty, he's pretty well prepared. All three of those guys, would you say it was Olin, Briggs, and
Alex
Brown. Was the third one? Yeah, they were on the Super Bowl team. So, yeah, they all got the joke.
Yes, and last year, Matt Forte was the fourth.
Okay.
So they, Olin's a relatively... this is Olin's second season. And I don't know why, but watching Olin is when I immediately thought, I know how Marquee can liven up their postgame show. Actually, they should just have Olin do it. Is Miguel Montero. For some reason, kind of the attitude, the I'll say anything bluntness.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think Miggy would be really good on that
show. You know what?
Yeah. I'd get fired after a week, but it would be worth it.
I wonder if his agent is still answering his calls. That's actually a pretty good. I don't recall how fluent Miggy was in English.
Honestly, Ozzy does.
Well, I got it.
And you can only understand a third of what Ozzy says.
I've never understood Ozzy. And I always wonder, do I have too much wax in my ears? Am I getting old? Is it?
Well, he
Ozzy on the score, and he talks so fast. Yes. I don't know what the hell he's saying.
It's the speed more than the accent. He runs all everything together. And so it's really hard to understand.
So it's this mishmash of Spanglish. And
it's very
and
fast Spanglish.
And jargon from English and speech cadences. Yeah, I can't quite crack the code when Ozzy talks. That's interesting. Yeah, it's a good call. Put Miggy on the set.
So the other game I remembered... It was a little more recent. 2012, Titans at Bears. No, Bears at Titans again.
Bears at Titans. 2012?
Yes.
Okay.
6-1 Bears and the 3-5 Titans.
Okay. And still not remembering it.
Lovie Smith matched up against the great Mike Munchak.
Yep.
First quarter score, Bears 28, Titans 2.
I remember this game. Didn't the defense score eight touchdowns in this game or something? Or didn't Peanut score two? Or
so the scoring started with Corey Wooten blocking a punt and returning it 5 yards for a touchdown. Or maybe he didn't. I don't know if he blocked the punt. He certainly recovered it for a touchdown.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Bears got the Titans on the board when Jamarcus Webb, the great Jamarcus Webb, got called for holding in the end zone. So 7-2.
That is sums it up.
Then an 8-yard Matt Forte touchdown run. Then a 46-yard Brian Urlacher interception return. Then Brandon Marshall caught the first of his 3 touchdown passes from Jay.
Okay.
So that rounded out the 28-2 first quarter. Other scores were 3 Robbie Gould field goals. 2 of them 25 yards or less. So obviously great red zone offense from the
Bears. Right.
Well, that was it because then there were the fourth quarter, there were 2 Brandon Marshall touchdowns. Chris Johnson scored an 80-yard touchdown rush for the Titans. I believe the Titans turned the ball over
five times.
So that's what I'm thinking. The defense actually only scored one touchdown. Special teams scored another. The rest was on the offense. I do still sort of remember that game. So the Bears were 6-1 going in or after that game?
That took them to 7-1.
Jesus Christ, and they missed the playoff. That was Lovie's last year. So I want to say their next game was probably against the Houston Texans on Sunday night. So Jay may have gotten hurt in that Tennessee game because the great Jason Campbell came on, and the Bears played two good teams and couldn't beat them and eventually slid out of the playoffs even though they won 10.
Why did they get 5 turnovers? Urlacher had an interception. Urlacher had a fumble recovery. Kelvin Hayden had 2 fumble recoveries.
Kelvin Hayden, wow.
And Chris Conte had a fumble recovery.
Now I've been triggered.
So 1, 2, thanks. 3, 4, 5. 5 turnovers.
Okay.
All right, well, let's solve the mystery here of the 2012 Bears and see what happened to them.
I mean, 7-1? So they went...
7-1 quickly became 9-6.
Was it the Texans the next week?
Yes. They lost 13-6 to the Texans.
Yeah, that was a Sunday night game that I went to. It was fucking miserable, like sleeted sideways all game.
Went to San Francisco, got beat 32-7.
That was the Colin Kaepernick's coming out party, basically.
Beat the Vikings, lost to the Seahawks in overtime. I don't remember that.
I don't remember that game, but no.
Lost to the Vikings. Lost to the Packers.
Oh, I remember the Seahawks game. That was Russell Wilson. The Bears had that game done. That was the game that basically helped Russell Wilson turn his corner in his career, where the Bears had a 7-point lead with like 2 minutes left in the game, and Seattle was down at their own like 6, and Wilson managed to put together a 90-yard-plus drive to tie it, and then they won in overtime. Absolutely, I remember that game now.
Yeah, so they lost 5 of 6, and then they won their last two games. They beat the Cardinals 28-13 and the Lions. And
Detroit, yeah.
And yeah. Then did not make the playoffs.
And it was unfortunate. You know, they won 10 games and missed the playoffs, which is hard to do, but it cost Lovie his job. The only other Houston game I remember, and it turns out I didn't quite remember because I thought the Bears won. But, you know, we were talking about we've talked in the past about the NFL and NBC and how it always seemed like a very special Bears game, right? In the early 80s, the NBC was the home of the AFC teams and CBS was the home of the NFC. Like we talked about the Bears hosting the Chargers, and it's on Channel 5 instead of Channel 2. So that happened in 1980. It's the only time I would have seen Earl Campbell play, and it was against Peyton. Somehow I thought the Bears won that game, just like they beat the Chargers, which you wouldn't have expected, but they didn't. However, I did look it up because I wasn't sure, and Peyton did not have a huge game. I think he had 60 yards, but Earl got over 200 yards rushing that game in Soldier Field with presumably Don Crickey at the microphone. So, I think Pastorini was their quarterback, but those were fun teams. And he was a fun running back, but the thing with Campbell was he was so huge and he took such a licking that he was out of the league. Like he lost his effectiveness after like 4 or 5 years. And we know that to be true of all running backs now. But it was a different time, and it just seemed kind of swift how quickly Earl Campbell's career ended. Or it didn't end. He went to the Saints. He reunited with Bum Phillips, and he joined a backfield with George Rogers, who was a big-time running back for them after winning a Heisman in college. But
South Carolina.
That's right. But Earl may have been a Heisman winner. If not, he was a great college player at Texas, but he really probably only had like 4 or 5 years. But I got to tell you, for those of us that lived through it, man, he was pretty freaking exceptional in those years.
Yes, and then just the combination of how big he was and the tearaway jerseys, so he'd be practically naked by the end of some runs where four guys would have a piece of jersey.
Supposedly, he one of the best. We talked about great quotes from John McKay. We've also referenced Bump Phillips before. When Bump Phillips died a couple years ago, I saw a bevy of fantastic quotes, and one that stuck with me was Earl Campbell was, you know, big and fast and running, but he wasn't a long, he wouldn't have been a long distance runner, let's say. And it was pointed out to Bump Phillips that Earl Campbell could not complete a 1 mile run. And Phillips said, well, when it's fourth and a mile, I ain't going to give him the ball.
That's good. So you mentioned Dan Pastorini. Well, I mentioned him, and then you mentioned him again.
Sure. This is what we do.
So on the ESPN Plus show, Peyton's Places, with the great Peyton Manning, which is actually a really entertaining show. He goes around. They did it for the 100th. Was it last year? The 100th anniversary of the NFL? Yeah. And he did things. He did these wacky stunts. Like there was a famous thing with the Giants where Y8 Tittle. Some Giant quarterback stood on the top of this building and threw a ball down, and one of their wide receivers caught it. Threw it, it was like a 20-story building. So him and Chris Carter reenacted that, and they did some other stuff. Well, one of the things he did was, so Dan Pastorini was the first quarterback to wear a piece of equipment that is now relatively standard for quarterbacks. Do you know what that piece of equipment was? It's not a cup.
Chin strap, mouth guard.
A flak jacket. He had hurt his ribs, and so they put this thing on him with, and like when I played in high school, our quarterback, because we ran the ball so much, I always had to wear one. So Peyton in the thing, him and Dan Pastorini go into the old Astrodome that's still there, because apparently occasionally George Strait needs to have a concert and somebody needs to have a tractor pull. and they put the flak jacket on Peyton. And Pastorini hits it with a baseball bat. It's actually really funny. He's like, really give me a good whack. And he hits it.
Is it one of those things where they had evolved so much in quality that, like, Pastorini was amazed at how...
That's a good question. I think the one Peyton had was like a version of the original. So Peyton's more like, are you really? You're going to hit me with that when we're in this thing? Yeah, there's one where him and some little white wide receiver that he played with in both Indianapolis and Brandon
Stokely.
Okay. No, Peyton. Stokely runs pass patterns, and Peyton throws different footballs from over the eras. He's got like the big one that looks like a pumpkin. Because, you know, the ball has got smaller and smaller and smaller over time.
Is that? I did not know that, actually.
And so Peyton shows how hard it is to throw him. And then Stokely actually really likes catching like the pumpkin. He's like, hey, I like this. It's like catching a beach ball. He can't really drop it. And then there's one where Deion Sanders teaches Peyton how to be a defensive back. And I think Deion's kid runs pass patterns against Peyton, and it doesn't go well because Peyton is not exactly a fast twitch athlete. So it's a pretty good show. But yeah, awesome. There's a Dan Pastorini one where you can watch him hit Peyton with a baseball bat in the ribs, which is kind of fun.
That's great. I'm actually quite tickled that we've name check Dan Pastorini so much. It's an otherwise sort of, in the whole scheme of things, a very, he's sort of like an undistinguished career, but he had a little bit of a bright light. He was the quarterback of a competitive Houston team for a while, but yeah, otherwise kind of forgotten to the sands of time. And certainly remembered. That's awesome. And it's true. I had him up on Wikipedia. It's one of the first things he's referenced for is the one of the first guys to wear a flak jacket. So that's like his thing. I never knew that.
Yeah, I wouldn't steer you wrong.
Appreciate that.
So despite the fact they've been in... Oh, my thing's not working. The Titans have been in Tennessee for quite a while now.
When you over look 20 at their, years.
At their all-time leaders... I don't know why this thing is taking so long to load here. There we go.
I wonder how many of them are Tennessee, because you're almost 50-50 now.
I think every one of these guys played.
No, you're not. You're not 50-50.
Forty years one place and 20 the other.
Yeah.
But everybody here is, well, I think everybody on this list played at least part of their career in Houston. Some of them, all of it. So, do you know who their all-time leading passer is?
All-time leading.
It's not Dan Blanda.
Could it be George Blanda from the AFL?
No, it's more recent than that. Let's just say that
But
Buddy would have been pissed that they were running.
Oh, I know who it is. It's Warren. Yeah, obviously Warren, it's Moon. Warren Moon. Yeah. I thought.
33,000 yards, 165 touchdowns. The running back played in, if I'm not mistaken, played in both places. I think he started.
It had to be Eddie George, right?
Yep.
Great running back.
He played a lot longer than Earl. Mm-hmm. The wide receiver played with Warren. One of their little guys running around.
Ernest Givens?
Ernest Givens.
Is it really?
Yes.
I didn't know. Okay.
7,900 yards. So he's not.
I wouldn't have guessed.
Better
they
than.
They had a whole. Yeah, they had like Jared Haywood Jeffries.
Was I spelled his name wrong. It always annoyed me. Right. Jeff Fires.
Jeff Fires.
God, you can't spell your own name. I wonder if it was just like they got it wrong on the jersey once and he just wouldn't ever correct it. It's fine. Just leave it there.
Yeah, but, okay. So interesting. I didn't know that Givens was the standout of that. They had like three or four guys. So, okay. So, all right. Ernest Givens. Wow.
All-time leading scorer.
Well, we got to go to our place kickers, right? Would Tony Fritsch from the late 70s, nope. early 80s?
This guy could be related to Jimmy the Greek.
Snyder?
Nope.
Oh. Man. You threw me for a loop on that.
Del
Greco.
El the Greek. I doubt it translates directly. Right. Over 1,000 points.
It would be Al of the Greek, I believe.
And then the winningest coach in Houston, Tennessee history.
Is
he
it
coached
Guppy?
All three places.
Yeah, it's Fisher.
Yep.
Yeah. It's the Guppy. Yeah. How about that?
142-20 and 0.
142 wins.
So his run there with McNair was, you know, I guess good enough.
Wait, what was his record?
He was 22 games over for them. 142 and 120.
142 and 120. Yeah.
Ties.
No ties.
Let's see. He went 7-9, 8-8, 8-8, 8-8. 13-3, 13-3, 7-9, 11-5, 12-4, 5-11, 4-12, 8-8, 10-6, 13-3. Boy, they're a long time.
Yeah.
8-8, 6-10, and finally fired.
And what was the overall? Was it at right at 500?
No, 22 over.
Right, you just said that. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of 8-8s. So he specialized in that over his career.
No, he did. Pretty much more, yeah, it was almost uncanny. Yeah, who knew? A member of the quote-unquote member of the 85 Bears would end up being some franchise's all-time winningest coach. Fun fact.
7 years just with them where he went either 8-8 or 7-9.
Wow.
So one of those guys who would never bottom out enough for you to get the number one pick.
It's brilliant, really, when you think about it.
And then they got McNair and didn't play him the first season.
Well, he was a first-round pick, and he was a sort of a fringe Heisman candidate, but he went to a Division III school, Alcorn State, which I want to say the same school that the year before the Bears drafted John Theory out of. I might be wrong.
Probably. They were probably scouting McNair. You know who we really like? This guy. Hey, wants that. Wait till you get a load of this guy.
Is that Charles Haley? Is that, yeah. I might be wrong. John Theory and Steve McNair may not have both gone to Alcorn State, but I want to say that they did and they were a year apart. But McNair was one of those fringe Heisman candidates, and he was still a first-round pick. But I think the reason he didn't end up getting an NFL, he didn't end up starting for a while was because he was drafted more for potential as the first-round pick, and they needed a few years to get him acclimated.
So he – did he not play at all his first season? When did he get drafted?
May not have.
Because the first year he played, he split time. He was Chris Chandler's backup, but another former Bear great, Will Fuhrer, actually played in more games than Steve McNair.
Dude, I never would have guessed that Will Fuhrer had played anywhere outside of his one.
So he did play. He started two games his rookie year. He went 2-0.
Okay.
But he wasn't the full time starter in '96 unless he got hurt, because he was he only started four games then, and then he started. Then in '97 he took over as the quarterback.
Gotcha.
But well, he was kind of a badass.
He was. He was an exciting player.
Then he had an affair with a woman who shot and killed. Things took a turn.
That's a polite way of putting it.
Yes. On the 4th of July, I remember that.
And yes, he and Jen Theory were teammates in college.
Oh, there you go.
And yet Jen Theory still lives.
So Wani had some interesting draft ideas. So he took Theory because you're right, he's going to be the next Charles Haley. He drafted Pat Riley from the University of Miami because he had torn his ACL. And it's like getting an extra first round draft pick. No, it's like getting a lineman who's already had his ACL repaired. That's what it's like. I didn't mention occasionally on that NBC Sports Chicago post game show, you get Dave Wannstedt.
Oh, I can't get enough of Dave. I accidentally hear him on the score every now and then.
If it's a Monday or Thursday night, you get Wani because he's around.
Yeah.
He's not off in Fox doing his other stuff, so he's around.
Further proving the theory that you don't even have to have been remotely connected to the 85 Bears, but just the Bears franchise to, no matter how you perform, you will always have an opportunity in town.
He's the last Bears coach to win a playoff road game.
1994 1994 Minnesota.
Minnesota. That was the Ultraback, Raymond.
Yeah, Raymond had a big game. Yeah, I remember that game. You know, we were only a couple years removed from Dickerson, so we were still sort of in that zone, that mode of usually going into the playoffs. It had actually been a very torturous, at the time, 2-year absence. And then the Bears proceeded to make one playoff appearance for the next, I think, 12 seasons. So
you kind of wonder, how many coaches have ever won a playoff road game for the Bears? Is it three?
It did it in 84.
Yeah. And Hallis?
In Washington. Yeah, because nobody else did it, right?
Right.
It's got to be.
Good Lord.
Just a playoff game. Like that.
They had a team for 100 years, and they got three. I know Hallis coached for 40 years, but still, that's 60 years, and two guys won road playoff games.
Yeah.
I'm sure Nagy is about to put his name on that list.
Yeah, you know, they just got to keep sliding out so they play on the road.
The good news for the Bears is they're currently, if the playoffs started today, they wouldn't be in them. But if the season can't be completed with everybody playing 16 games, the NFL is considering adding a playoff team to both leagues.
All
currently,
right.
That would be the Bears in the NFC. How exciting.
Greatest
Maybe that's why the Bears suddenly have a COVID outbreak. They're trying to sabotage it so they can make the playoffs. Ryan Pace always thinking.
Yeah, it's a really progressive organization for whom we root. When you think about it,
yeah,
it's why we remember so much crap.
I think that in life you should be able to. You shouldn't pick a religion until you're like 18.
Uh-huh.
And you shouldn't pick your sports teams for good until about that age.
I'm
you
not
be
sure
allowed
how
to just because my dad saddled me with Catholicism, the Cubs, and the Bears.
And Jerry Faust in Notre Dame football.
He was the most successful high school coach. It's not going to work.
I don't know. So basically just be a front runner until you can.
No, you get to change. Like you root, you sit and watch games with your mom or your dad or whoever.
Yeah, yeah.
But then when you're 18, you have to declare, and you can make an educated decision.
Right.
It's like your confirmation.
Uh huh.
You're like, all right, you know what? Sorry, Dad, I can't.
I like that. Things. Right, right. When I chalk it up, right. They've only won two titles in 70 years.
Now the problem for me is that had I been given that choice, I would have picked the teams I still root for.
Yeah. Certainly in 1990 when I turned 18, I'd be crazy not to pick the Bears still.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
And by then I was deluding myself into.
Yeah.
Well, the Cubs just went to the playoffs last year.
That's right. 89, 84. That's right.
We got Greg Maddux. We're never going to let Greg Maddux go. As long as we have this guy, we're going to be in the playoff hunt.
Yeah. All right. I'm depressed.
Yeah. Nothing like bringing it around. So next week, I believe.
Who's the next opponent?
Oh no, it's the Vikings, and then a bye week. So we got the Vikings. That
good.
Be fun. Oh, we got to break out all the Jerry Kramer or the Jerry Burns
Get your Jerry Burns, some Tommy Kramer DUI stories, maybe. What's the boat on Lake Minnetonka?
Oh, yeah,
perhaps if we want, if we want to go blue.
Fred Smoot in the sex boat.
We just have to make sure we don't run the risk of doing too much because we played the Vikings twice. So we'll have to pace ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah, because it was easy with the Lions. There's not a whole lot.
I'm not worried about making fun of Wayne Fonts
in the second one.
There's plenty of dry powder on that one still anyway. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, then the next week it's the Vikings.
Works for me, man.
All right.
Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Mike. Go Bears.
Go Bears.
Many of us have herpes.